Hello, welcome to the podcast number one. And this podcast is all about who were the Plains Indians. So to start with, we need to understand that the Plains Indians were Indian tribes. And there was many, many different ones of them. Some of the biggest well-known ones were the Sioux, the Crow, the Comanches. These Indians were not unified, they're all separate, and sometimes they were enemies of each other, but they did depend on each other for survival. The largest Plains Indian tribe were the Sioux, and the Sioux had lots of little sort of bands within them, like the Lakota and seven sub-tribes. The Plains Indians loved the harsh Great Plains, and they had adapted their lifestyles to living on the Great Plains. This meant that when white settlers moved there or travelled through there later, it's going to lead to conflict. So the first thing we need to look at is Indian society. So the tribes were made up of bands, and the band would be about 10 to 50 families within that tribe. And these would often meet once or twice a year for the buffalo hunt. The chiefs were the leaders of Indian society, and the chief would have a particular skill, something they were really, really good at. Example would be their wisdom, or their fighting, or their spiritual connections. And there's some famous chiefs like Red Cloud and Sitting Bull. The chiefs didn't really have any actual power because everything had to be agreed by a tribal council, and there were a group of elders, medicine men, and the chiefs as well. And you would also have warrior brotherhoods who were trained young fighters. They had a big part in the band and the tribe. They would lead the buffalo hunt, and they went to war. They didn't, interestingly enough, have to follow the council's orders, so this sometimes led to conflict and problems. We've just mentioned warfare, so the second thing we're going to look at now is Indian warfare. Now, unlike Western society, there was no honour in killing. So bravery wasn't going to war and killing lots of people. It was from something called counting coup. Now, bravery was not killing the enemy, but getting close enough to the enemy to touch them without being hurt. And they would have a special stick, a coup stick, which they would get close enough to the enemy to touch, but they wouldn't kill. If they did have to kill, which sometimes they did, they might take the scalp of the enemy. Now, scalp is the top of the basically the bit where your hair is. That's the scalp there. And that was like a trophy of your bravery. But also stealing horses was evidence of success. Now, if you think about it, taking the scalp of an enemy, it's pretty harsh. So a white man saw that as another reason why the Plains Indians were savages. Indians mainly fought to protect their hunting grounds or to steal horses, but they weren't interested in land. So that's society and warfare. Now, they weren't didn't believe in our Christian God or any Christian sort of standard things. They believed in something called the Great Spirit, Wakatankan, who created the world. And in their belief system, everything was equal and sacred, people and nature. And they connected with the Great Spirit by doing these dances, like there's a buffalo dance and a sun dance, etc. And some land was considered particularly sacred, like the Black Hills, because they were burial grounds, and land was absolutely sacred. They believed it could not be bought or owned by anyone, as it belonged to everyone. And if you farmed or mined, for the majority of tribes, that was disrespectful. And then looking at family life, very equal society, Plains Indians, very equal. Everyone had a role as equally important. So the roles might be different, but everyone was considered important and they worked together, and that was key to survival. Women, who are called squaws, were responsible for the home. They turned the buffalo remains into hinds and meat. The men were responsible for hunting, looking after the horses and protection. And old people were often members of a tribal council, and contributed to it in that way. And young people had a role as well, but young people were left quite free. Wasn't a disciplined society or anything like that. The idea is that young people, their role was to just enjoy life. So they would, what we would consider, have quite a free life there as well. And just to finish, we talk about the role of horses. Horses were really essential on the plains. Hunt, buffalo, constant travel, but were also important for status. The more horses you had, the more important you were. So just to sum up, that was the introduction of who were the Plains Indians. Thank you for listening. Hello, welcome to episode number 2. And we're going to focus entirely on survival on the plains. Now, the plains, the Great Plains, were very difficult to live on. There was very little trees. The weather could either be very hot or very cold. Very, very difficult. Now, we learned from the previous episode that the Plains Indians didn't believe that they could own land. So they didn't farm and they didn't mine. So therefore, everything they needed for survival, it had to be from what they hunted. And the animal that they hunted was the buffalo. Now, if you think about a buffalo, I want you to think of a cow and times it by like 4. They're massive animals, absolutely massive animals. And that animal was the animal that meant survival of the Plains Indians. Now, it was also berries and stuff like that as well. So it wasn't just the buffalo, but the buffalo was their means of survival. So survival was based on hunting buffalo, and buffalo, loads of them, millions of them, and they would move around the Great Plains, and the Indians, the Plains Indians, would follow them. So that meant their lifestyle was they were nomadic. Now, nomadic means that they travelled around. So basically, these big herds of buffalo, they would travel around the plains and the Plains Indians would hunt them. And that was key. A big part of what they needed was those hunting skills. And they lived in, it was like a tent called a teepee. And those teepees were really quick, really practical, did everything they needed to, but they could be packed up and moved quite easily. So they were perfect. Teepees were perfect for the plains. They were made from wood and buffalo skin. They were warm in the winter and cool in the summer. And some Plains Indians tribes lived in wooden lodges during the winter. The buffalo is a key thing when we look at that lifestyle. So if we think about, there was millions of buffalo on the Great Plains, but the Plains Indians would never take any more than what they needed. So they would only hunt exactly what they needed. And the hunting of the buffalo was a key event with tribes from all over. That was when they join up for the spring hunt. And there was 3 key parts to this. So first off was the buffalo dance. So this was speaking to the Great Spirit, and it was a spiritual ceremony to call the buffalo close and to pray for a successful hunt. Then you have the hunt itself. The hunt was very organized. They only had two or three hunts a year, and it was just enough to feed the bands, and the warriors would stampede the buffalo and hunt them. And then after they got the buffalo, then there was the processing, and it was women and the children would process all of the buffalo so not one bit of it was wasted. So every part of the buffalo helped the survival of the Plains Indians. So let me give you some examples. The skull was used in religious ceremonies. The brain was used in tanning the hides. So that's part of processing the skin of the buffalo into hides to make it usable. Even the tongue was used as a hairbrush, but it was also eaten raw. That was a delicacy. Yum, yum. The heart is the only part of the buffalo that wasn't physically used, but the heart was cut out from the body, left on the ground, and that was symbolic to give new life to the herd. The buffalo was sacred, man's relative who gave his life so people could live. The heart might also be eaten raw so the warrior could take the strength and the power of the buffalo. Even the dung, the stuff that came out the buffalo's bum, was used. And that's because there's not much wood, there's not much fuel. So the dried poo was used for fuel. You could burn it, buffalo chips. It was also smoked by men in special ceremonies, but I'm not too sure about that. The bladder was used for food bags. The intestines were used for buckets and cooking vessels. The hooves were used to make glue. Honestly, every single part of the buffalo was used. So the buffalo was important to warfare. It was important. It was the centre of warrior life. It's where boys became men. The bones were used to make knives. The sinews, the parts of muscles, were used as bowstrings. Society, the buffalo was central to Indian society. Men went on the hunt, women and children processed. They would join together, bring communities together for this. Everything was central to that. And then just for survival, living, every part of the buffalo was used. A teepee, we talked about teepee in the previous part of the podcast. The teepee was made from 10 to 20 skins of a buffalo. And a buffalo could feed the Indians for months. And they even dried the meat and ate it in the winter. And the buffalo was only hunted enough to keep the population going. So everything was central. And for this topic, you need to understand how the Plains Indians lived, because later on, we're going to find that some of these things were taken away. So you need to understand how important they are in case for the later part of this story when they're took away. So that ends episode 2, and that was survival, and we've talked about teepees and the buffalo. Thank you very much. Hi there, welcome to episode number 3, which is about migration and early settlement in the American West. This fits in with the specification for EdExcel to help you with your revision. So, what we need to look at first is what factors made people start to move, to migrate to the American West. So, essentially, we're looking at why did people start to settle and migrate to the American West. Now, the first big concept is this idea of manifest destiny. Manifest destiny. And basically, this is all around Americans believing that their country should occupy the entire continent, all of America, from the East Coast to the West Coast on the Pacific. So it's a little bit of, we are really important, it is our right to fill the whole of America. This view became known as manifest destiny, and it encouraged this belief that if you're a doing the right thing if you're a good American. It was the God-given duty of Americans to spread civilization and democracy. So basically, this idea of manifest destiny is it's your duty, it's what God would want you to do, is to spread and civilize the whole of America. Manifest destiny, it was almost like a mission to cross the breadth of America and the land and all the land, and who should govern it and populate it should be Americans. So a manifest destiny, the belief that non-Native American people, that it was their God-given duty to settle across the whole of North America and civilize, basically. Now, if we look at what was going on at that time, in 1837, the USA was hit by an economic depression. So things at that time were quite difficult. In the East, the banks collapsed, savings were lost, and lots of jobs were lost. So what then happened was there was high unemployment, and it drove the people in the East to look westwards with this hope of a better life. Things had gone very wrong in the East, so maybe the West would hold that escape for people. Now, they were having messages of unsettled, really fertile land, land that could grow crops on, land that they could settle on in Oregon and California. And these messages were coming to the East. And farmers in the Mississippi Valley struggled because of the depression, and prices of wheat and corn were right down. So the chances, this idea that they could go and farm in Oregon and California seemed really attractive. So basically what we see is this movement, this pull factor from people from the East to the West. In 1842, the US government encouraged settlers to stake a claim for the ownership of the land, because they introduced an act called the Preemption Act, which allowed you to buy 160 acres of land for $1.25 an acre. Now imagine how attractive that would seem if you were struggling in the East. What we also saw is Mexico becoming part of the USA, and this encouraged settlers to move over there. And in 1846, there was a treaty with Britain, and that saw Oregon become part of the USA. And that was now accessible, attractive to settlers. It had a good climate. It was good to go there. You also saw a pass through the Rocky Mountains. Mountain men, who were people who were quite comfortable in the mountains, blazed these trails, and that enabled settlers to reach areas like Oregon and California. So what we see is, why do people start to settle in the West? We see this idea of manifest destiny. We see in the East an economic depression. We see really, really cheap packages of land, and we see the mountain men given trails so that you could get to the West, all of which was really, really attractive to people that were struggling in the East. So you've got manifest destiny, economic depression, really cheap land, and now a way to get to the West. Thank you very much. That is episode 3. Why did people move to the West? Migration and early settlement. Hi there. Welcome to episode 4, which is the process and the problems of migrating. So when we're talking about migrating, we're talking about moving from the East to the West and occupying the American West. Now, if you were going to go from the East to Oregon or California, that would take you around 4 months. Remember, you'd be doing it on foot or with wagons. It would be really dangerous and really long to make that journey. So
we looked at in the last episode, some of the reasons why people were making that really dangerous journey, but they were determined to get that fresh start and those opportunities in the West, and they were getting all these messages back around that. So many families, they faced a series of dangers, and they sometimes took risks to get to their destination more quickly. And there were different routes, and some of these routes were tried and tested by the mountain men, but some people tried to take their own routes, which led to hazards. If you were going on one of these journeys, you'd have to think about your route, you'd have to think about your food supplies, and you would see that the food supplies would run low if things went wrong in the journey. So it's a really well planned out journey and a really dangerous one. Always be wary of the shortcuts. Now, the cautionary tale of where it all goes wrong is the Donner Party, and this is something on the specification. So the Donner Party, and it was led by the Donner brothers, Jacob and George, they set off from Independence, that's a place in Missouri, in 1846. And their aim, where they wanted to get, was California. By June, they had reached Little Sandy River, and the Donners and others had decided to head to Fort Bridger. And they were going to take a shortcut, the Hastings Cutoff, rather than follow the more established, tried and tested route. So they decided to take a shortcut. This went awfully, awfully wrong. And the Donner Party lost 4 wagons, many oxen and cattle, and a whole month of time was wasted. So if you think about, you're looking at the mountains there, you're looking at the weather, you have a really tight schedule to be able to make that journey. But they lost a whole month's time. Now, when they crossed the Sierra Nevada mountain range, the snow came, and the Donner Party became stranded. They couldn't get anywhere. They were stuck in snow. It was absolutely awful. By mid-December, their food supplies were running low and people began to die. A small group of 17 men, women and children had left on foot, with 7 of them eventually making it to California. So they decided that they were going to chance it. Of the 87 original members of the Donner Party, 46 survived to eventually reach California. But many of them had the horrific perspective of to survive. They ate the dead to survive. So they ate the people who died whilst in those mountain range. So when we're talking about migration, the point of this episode is how dangerous it is, how difficult it is, and how hazardous it is. So that is the Donner Party is your case study of how difficult that would be. Thank you very much. That episode was around the process and the problems of migration. Hi there, welcome to episode number 5, and we're going to look at the migration of a religious group in the early settlement of the West, which was the Mormon migration, 1846 to 47. So the Mormons were a religious group, and they moved around quite a lot in their early establishment because many Christians didn't approve of some of their practices and beliefs, such as polygamy, which is the belief where a man could marry several wives at once. So what we're looking at is another group. We looked at the Donner Party the last episode, and that showed what could go wrong. And we're going to look at the migration of another group, which is the Mormons, which shows if you carefully plan it out, that migration could be really successful. So let's just give you a bit of context for the Mormons. In 1845, the Mormons were ordered to leave Illinois because rioters murdered their leader, Joseph Smith. And that was because they weren't agreeing with what was going on and it all got very heightened. Now, their new leader, Brigham Young, believed that God had called on the Mormons to migrate to move to Salt Lake City, and that was south of the Oregon Trail. And he felt that this message was given to him that the Mormons should go and settle there. The Salt Lake Valley was outside US territory at the time, and the Mormons hoped that they could settle there and escape persecution. So Young wanted the Mormons to make the migration west in the spring of 1846. He planned it out carefully. He thought about the weather. He thought about on the trail that there was grass for the livestock to eat. But because things got difficult in Illinois, they had to move in February. And the weather was bitterly cold, and it was a very slow and difficult first stage of migration. They congregated at Omaha in the northern starting point of the Oregon Trail. They decided that it was too late to travel on, so they waited until the following spring, and they had to endure a harsh winter. But they thought about when the timing would go. In April 1847, a small party of around 150 Mormons, led by Young, set off to Salt Lake City. And it's a long journey, it's about 2,000 kilometres. It was like an advance party where they kind of tested out the trails and did things to help the people that would come after them. So they were supplied with enough food for a year, a portable boat to help them with the river crossings. And that advance party marked out the best route to follow. They cleared the route if there was anything needed. They located water sources. They set up river crossings, and they even planted crops. So this is the just an example of really clever, good leadership and good planning. By the time Young had reached Salt Lake Valley, a much larger wagon trail of 1,500 Mormons just started setting off there, and they followed the same route. Because of the good work of the advance party, this wagon train had a clear route to follow, and they managed to successfully settle there and get there safely. Now, when we're looking at the Mormon migration, Brigham Young's leadership was very, very important in the success of the migration. And that's just on the journey. He basically, before they left, organised a count of all the Mormons, and he planned every section of the journey and the settling. He consulted with trail guides. The migrants were divided into manageable groups, each with a leader. And Young was really, really insistent on discipline. And each party, each group had a set of skills within that so that they could survive if they needed to. One of the really, really good things that Young did is he taught the migrants how to form their wagons into a circle at night. So by putting all the wagons in a circle, they could keep their livestock safe, which they keep in the middle, from attack or getting lost. It was all planned out, rest points as well. So that allowed a successful migration. And when they got to the Great Salt Lake, if you were to look at pictures of the Salt Lake before it was settled, it is a harsh, arid, dry landscape. Now, it's called Salt Lake City because the lake is so salty. It's the land around it is too poor to grow crops on. So basically, his leadership basically really allowed them to settle and establish there, and there's still a significant Mormon community there today. So the Mormons built irrigation systems from the freshwater streams to allow the crops to build, and he organized different groups. He split the land up. It was really, really cleverly done. So all the new settlements were planned, and each had a particular product and different skill sets within that. And they got the water supply sorted and allowed the community to flourish. So you might use the Donner Party as an example of a migration gone wrong, but then at the same time you could use the Mormon migration as an example of a migration gone very, very right. And you would argue that it was the leadership and the planning of the Mormon migration that allowed it to be really, really successful. Thank you very much. That's talking about a successful migration from the east to the west, which was the Mormon migration. Thank you very much. Bye.